getting in touch with your EMS community, women ignoring heart disease symptoms, gaining weight on night shift, and we'll have a special segment on the advantages of mechanical CPR devices in cardiac arrest care. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of The MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is The MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you all for checking out this week's show. In this week's EMS news items, we're going to be looking at how those of us working night shifts might have to work a little harder on our health to keep fit. Then in this week's special tip segment recorded at EMS World Expo in Nashville, I bring you a discussion I had with Dr. Joe Holly from the City of Memphis Fire Department on their recent purchase and use of the Lucas II mechanical CPR devices. How do these devices fare when used to assist in the care of cardiac arrest patients? We'll find out about what he thinks later in the show after the news. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure you check out the links and additional information you'll find for you over at the MedicCast blog at medicast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. Just click that link and it'll take you right to the most recent episode. And of course, you can scroll down there and find other previous episodes as well. There's also a search box there in the upper right-hand corner of the page. If you're looking for something in particular, enter the keywords there. But take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show. Understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, I hope you'll do so. You can always get a hold of me by email. Shoot those emails into podmedic@mac.com. Also, I know we had some minor audio quality issues last week on the show, and I heard from several of you about it. I think we've got that worked out this week, but I want to thank those of you who checked in with me. It's a team effort here at the MedicCast, and I appreciate your heads up and your help. Please keep in touch and make sure I put out the best quality show for you each week. Okay, enough introductions. Let's go ahead and get on with the show. Starting with the news, it's coming right up. Kicking off the news for EMS folks this week is a look at what One Service is doing to reach out to its community and serve their needs better. I've talked about the importance of getting in touch with the people you serve to help them better understand what it is you do as an EMS service. The Lower Umpqua Hospital District EMS Department put an article in the local paper and their news website about their services. They include a description of their 650-square-mile coverage area, a discussion on how they're funded, and their staffing levels. The authors also reference the amount of training and ongoing education that goes into the creation of their EMS providers at each level. I also like that they include a mention of services, a survey that they implemented recently to help them figure out whether there was enough support to fund a second due ambulance in their area to help cover the 1,100 calls they get each year. The article also goes into the costs associated with the purchase of their equipment, including the cost of the ambulance itself and the cost of big ticket items inside, like heart monitors. You can create an article like this yourself and submit it to your local print and web news sources to educate your public about what you guys do to serve your communities. I urge you to look at this article. Maybe you want to model your own article after it. It's a great example of how to do one of these, and you can go a long way to helping the people you serve understand your challenges and successes with an article just like this. If you do write an article like this to promote your community EMS program, make sure you send me an email about it. Send me the link, and maybe I can share it here on the show in a future episode. Next up in our news this week, let's take a look at another story that focuses on the differences between male and female patients when it comes to heart disease, heart attack, and cardiac arrest. A recent study looked at these differences and came out with a report that women routinely wait longer than men to report cardiac symptoms, often to their detriment. The study was presented at the Canadian Cardiovascular Congress. The study's authors looked at people with suspected cardiovascular disease and conducted the study in two parts. First, they looked at people's perceptions of their chest pain and other cardiac symptoms and their decisions to seek assistance or not. Then the researchers looked at a second group of patients to separate the patients according to their gender and how they manage their symptoms. They even came up with a new term called the, quote, symptomatic tipping point, end quote. This is the point at which symptoms become severe enough to cause the person to call 911 or otherwise seek medical help. Initially, both men and women ignore the symptoms they're experiencing, attributing them to stress or indigestion. Women, however, wait longer to seek help, often because they don't think that women get heart attacks as frequently as men. They are unaware that heart attack is the leading cause of death in women, too. Another reason cited is that women often put their own health as second to that of their family members, causing them to put health issues of their own on the back burner in favor of taking care of family needs. Clearly, this study points to the fact that we need to do more to educate women in our communities about the dangers of heart disease and that they are just as high at risk for heart attack as men. I urge you to find ways to engage people in educational efforts on this and other health-related issues. Finally, in the news this week for EMS professionals, I bring you another story on the health risks that accompany shift work, particularly night shift. In a study from the online edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers looked at the metabolic processes of a group of volunteers who were set up to work a series of night shifts with sleeping during the day. What they found was that, on average, they burned about 55 fewer calories than their day shift counterparts. The study's authors say that while this is a small number of calories, it can add up over time to a significant number of fewer calories burned. The authors propose that the shift in natural circadian rhythms is the reason for the change in metabolism. They also say that it is unlikely that you would adjust to the new schedule, since on your days off, you're probably going to revert back to normal daytime routines. This is something that affects most of us in EMS. The solution, I think, might be to adjust those modifiable risk factors we can control to account for this shift in metabolism. A dietitian quoted in the article saying that allowing more time for some additional exercise each day would help offset the metabolic shift, as well as eating a healthier diet and eating smaller portions of food when working night shifts. In this case, I think knowledge is power. If you know that your metabolism is going to slow down when working nights, you can make allowances. The question is, will you? Let me know what you think about this or any of the news items in this week's show. Just shoot me an email with your comments or questions, or maybe even leave a comment in the article itself over at medicast.com/blog. I look forward to hearing from you. At EMS World Expo at the Physio Control Podcast Studio, I was joined a couple weeks ago by Dr. Joe Holly and the disaster podcast host, Sam Bradley, to talk about why the City of Memphis, Tennessee Fire Department placed Lucas mechanical CPR devices on their units. We discuss how these devices assist with high-quality cardiac arrest care and also some of the evidence beginning to be collected by that department on how ROSC, or Return of Spontaneous Circulation, and survival to discharge rates are affected. Let's check it out. Hi, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic here at EMS World Expo 2014 in Nashville, Tennessee. We're here in the Physio Control Podcast Studio having a great time on day two here at Expo. And before we get started with the rest of the show, I want to give a shout out to a few folks. We've got MediView, Fire Trader, the Ohio Association of Emergency Medical Services, Mangar International, all right around our booth. They get stuck listening to us nonstop here for the whole duration of the conference, and we want to give them a little bit of a shout out for having to put up with us. So we appreciate you guys listening to us and all of our insanity for the rest of the show. But we do want to thank Physio-Control as well for being the episode sponsor for this episode. And the reason for that is we're actually going to be talking a little bit about mechanical CPR devices and what's the science behind it, what's the anecdotal evidence say, what's coming in the way of maybe some updated data and studies, and we're going to have that discussion here. To start that off, I'd like to ask Dr. Joe Holley to introduce yourself. And Joe, tell everybody a little bit about where you're from and what you do.
Sounds great. My name's Joe Holley. I'm the EMS Medical Director for Memphis Fire Department and many of the EMS agencies in and around Memphis, Tennessee, as well as the State of Tennessee EMS Medical Director.
Excellent. And I also have Sam Bradley here, one of my co-hosts on the Disaster Podcast. And Sam, tell everybody a little bit about your background.
I have been a paramedic for a long time, currently working in a fire department environment, and I spend my week's doing the disasterpodcast.com with Dr. Joe and Jamie, and we have a great time doing that.
We do have a great time. Yes. So we're going to be talking about mechanical devices, and Joe, you just recently did a webinar with Physio-Control on the Lucas device and what you've seen in I guess, Memphis is now using the Lucas, correct?
Correct.
So tell us a little bit about what drove you to, in Memphis, to say we want to put this mechanical CPR device on our units.
Well, I think that whole process started, I think, where most everybody starts, which is we have a large fire department, have a lot of personnel, and weren't really seeing the results that we thought we ought to be seeing out of lots of trained people doing CPR, as well as a recognition that the studies in the past were pretty clear that CPR couldn't be done very well in the back of a truck, moving vehicle. We had a lot of instances where we had to move the patient from wherever we found the patient to someplace where we had more room, et cetera. So there was an awful lot of inconsistency in our CPR and an awful lot of pauses, et cetera. And that drove us to try to look for a way to fix those issues in a way that would fit in with the fire department and allow us to improve the quality of the CPR that we were delivering, at least over a long time.
And so that consistency aspect, you
the
know,
consistency,
rather,
exactly.
rather than having all those pauses, and you identified where you were having the breakdown, but then it was how do we fill those gaps?
Correct. So it was certainly a recognition that, I think for Memphis, we transport a lot of patients in cardiac arrest. We try to work them on the scene and not transport if obviously the efforts are futile. But at the same time, the sort of social milieu there in Memphis is very much about transporting the patient to the hospital. So we do a lot of that, probably more of that than we need to from a pure cardiac arrest standpoint. But if we're going to be doing that, then we need to be able to provide good quality CPR en route. And obviously, that's a very challenging process. It's also dangerous for the medic,
right,
who's got to try to stand up in the back of a moving vehicle and hold himself in place while he's trying to do quality CPR. And obviously, it's just simply not possible to do. So that was a methodology that we could have a device doing that and not have a medic at risk doing that.
Why did you pick the Lucas over another device? I mean, was there a reason that you saw? Was it an ease of use issue or something?
It was a little bit of both. You know, I think the data out there on the devices themselves seems pretty similar, and my sense is that currently probably all of those mechanical CPR devices are all equally effective in doing what they do. So what we did was pilot each of those products with a group of our medics and ask them to utilize them for a couple of weeks and which did they feel most comfortable with, were they able to get on most quickly. We looked at sort of a cost analysis associated with that too, whether ongoing costs associated with the use of the device. And ultimately, you know, that process led us to choose the Lucas device because that was the choice of the guys in the field that were going to be using it.
Well, it's interesting because one of the counties I work for was one of the five counties in the entire country to do the first pilot on Lucas. And I remember the guys looking at this thing going, are you kidding me? What is this thing? But once they started using it, you don't even try to take it away from them.
We are. Same experience for us.
You're having the same experience?
Absolutely. Do not take our Lucas device away. If you're going to take it in for maintenance, we want another one here before you leave.
Oh, seriously.
With it.
It's like manual CPR doesn't exist anymore. But your protocol's interesting because one of the things that they focus on in my area is you want to do as much of your workup as you can on the scene, because once you have to move that patient, mm-hmm. then you stop doing compressions. And so it's not just a matter of, okay, we've run out of things to do, so we're going to call it. It's, you know, we're hoping to get Ross back. So we're not doing as much CPR en route because hopefully you've got something back. Because mm-hmm. there's no point in taking a person to the hospital that clearly isn't going to survive.
But you can leave the Lucas on the person.
Oh, absolutely.
We recommend you do. I mean, I know in my system we actually have the Lucas device as well, and we're a volunteer system, which you know, our issue was manpower. Mm-hmm. We didn't have consistent manpower coming out to cardiac arrests. We didn't know what time of day we were going to get who. Mm-hmm. So we needed a
good
device
point.
That was going to fill that gap for us, and it's done a good job for that. But we recommend we leave it on mm-hmm. because we don't know if they're going to go back into arrest.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's a question of just turning it back on and ready to go.
And we do the same.
We call it Firefighter Lucas because it truly is like having another guy.
You're right.
Yeah.
And it's a guy who doesn't get tired.
That's
and
right.
And always does it right.
He doesn't complain either.
And I think that's what really sets apart manually performed CPR from the devices themselves. It's not that people can't do good quality CPR. There's no question people do great quality CPR.
For the
CPR.
First few minutes, yeah.
Right. But I think in that environment, you have a million distractions. You're trying to do a whole lot of other stuff. And you get if you're doing them right, it's very energy consuming. So you're working very hard. So you get tired very quickly. You get distracted very quickly. You have, you're busy trying to pump 100
the
times
depth
a minute.
The compressions is going to.
Exactly right. You got to get all those things just right and stay right inside those parameters. And if you have a way to provide sort of immediate feedback, that I think it's a two-edged sword to some extent. That immediate feedback ensures that I am manually doing CPR the right way, but I think it also quickly lets you know this is really hard work, and in 2 or 3 minutes I'm done, and I got to swap somebody else in here because you just can't maintain that as well. So the device.
Another thing we found too, because one of the EMS agencies I work with is really into, let's go to that next level, let's go to high performance CPR, and they have a software suite that allows them to really look at these mm-hmm. things, and they were finding that people were compressing too fast most of mm-hmm. the time. So they even gave the crews, every crew in the county got a metronome.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's one thing about the Lucas as well, is you have that consistency mm-hmm. in the pace. But, you know, if you are doing manual, then that's another good option is having a metronome.
No doubt. Metronomes are vitally important. I agree completely. Yeah, matter of fact, the Lucas device has a metronome on it as well.
Staying Alive probably isn't as appropriate.
Well, it's not bad. It's just after 3 or 4 rounds of that song, you're kind of done with it, right?
So, yeah, true.
You know, but I mean, I think there's no question that those kind of feedback things are vitally important. As is that high-performance CPR, that pit crew approach to CPR where everybody sort of has their assigned task. And I think that's been one of the interesting, unexpected benefits of mechanical CPR for us is there's this sort of frenetic bit of activity for a minute and a half around sort of arriving at the side of the patient who's in cardiac arrest
and
getting your tools out, getting all your toys set up and all that sort of stuff. But it's really interesting. Once that device goes on, the whole scene just mm-hmm. kind of calms.
And
people are able to kind of step back and sort of say, all right, like, we got this. So it has an amazing calming effect. It really does.
What I found was that it was taking a mechanical task that really didn't require a human to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think about it, it was just a press up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And by giving a mechanical task to a mechanical device, it enables you to then sit back and be the human,
mm-hmm.
be the thinking person on the scene and go, okay, I can really apply my critical thinking and, you know, now the H's and T's make a whole lot more sense, right?
Exactly right.
Because you have the time to really think about it. You're not worrying about, has this guy been compressing too long? Mm-hmm. Who's paying attention to that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which at a time, as the senior medic on the scene, it was my job to oversee everything.
Right.
And I was supposed to be remembering that they need to switch out.
But your ALS guy, if you're limited on them, they need to be doing ALS stuff.
Right.
They need to be getting drugs on.
That's why I said now
the
you can pay attention to
the
H's and T's because you know you got compressants taken care of. You got a guy with a metronome that's paying attention to the respirations.
Yep.
And you can sit back and you can bag this person all day long.
And that really makes a difference, is to have that 10,000-foot view and see what everybody's doing.
Absolutely.
But medics didn't have that luxury because they were having to compress the chest.
And I think you hit on it beautifully. You know, CPR is a good CPR is a very repetitive, very mechanical task. And it not only is it just, you know, mechanically doing compressions, but you got to have the right speed, the right depth, no pauses, etc. That's a perfect engineering arrangement for a mechanical device who's going to do that consistently, you know, nonstop, same depth, same speed, never stop until you turn the button off. And I think that's really what sets mechanical CPR apart from manual CPR. Not necessarily this head-to-head, is it better than human CPR? I don't think it is. I think it is better than human CPR over a time frame, because you can do great quality CPR, you just can't do it for long, and the pauses creep in because you have to pay attention to it. That device doesn't get distracted. It just goes off and on. And so if you want distraction from the device, you just turn it off.
Yeah. Let's talk about the science, because there are, you know, the Link study is the one that everybody talks about. Mm-hmm. And people, you were telling me earlier before we started recording that people often, you think, misinterpret what that study is saying.
Yeah, I think that study was done in Europe. It was a very large-scale study, and it looked to see was mechanical CPR as good as manual, human-based CPR. And the answer was, yes, it was as good as. And so I think that folks see that or read that study and think, well, my people can do just as good a job as that machine is. Absolutely. I agree that they can. I think it.
But will
again,
they?
Well, that's part of it. And again, I think it does indeed then come down to those mechanical issues about how do you continuously do that without it being a problem. And so if you looked at that Link study data, the folks that were being compared to the mechanical device were retrained every 6 months so that they were performing at peak ability in their comparison to the mechanical device. And I think, again, that just reinforces to me that good quality CPR can be done by folks, but the question is, do you have the time, energy, and resources to retrain your people every 6 months to ensure that they are at peak performance all the time? I would say no. Even the best intended situation is going to have a real hard time being able to do that, and therefore could you not replace that entire process with a mechanical device and not have to worry about any of that anymore, except making sure that your guys are able to get that device on and focus instead on just the stuff you guys were talking about earlier, the more cerebral functions of understanding what's happening in cardiac arrest and the physiology and what interventions need to be done and when they need to be done and are they being done correctly to maximize ultimately the outcome of the patient.
And like you were saying, Jamie, in a volunteer situation, you may not have the personnel
exactly
you need
right.
Yeah. That you can switch out regularly.
You have a driver and a paramedic, and you know, a 70-year-old fire police guy shows up and says, "What can I do? I can direct traffic around your ambulance for you."
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, now what do we do?
Yeah.
Now what do we do?
That's
you know,
it.
We can do CPR, but we can't do anything else. The ALS interventions are out the window unless I can get another couple of pairs of hands here or set the Lucas device up.
Right.
And that's what's kind of been the option I think that people are going with.
Mm-hmm. And I think also as you look at that, you know, in those limited resource scenarios, you guys can manually do CPR, but you know, it doesn't take long. I mean, that's really great. You can do CPR for 6 minutes at really high quality. What's different at the end of 6 minutes than when you started? No other help is coming. You've got all you're going to get because you're out of resources. So, you know, yes, we bought the guy some time, but you didn't use the time to do anything any different. You didn't have the resources to do anything any different.
You didn't maximize your efficiency.
Well, right, because you can't. You're out of resources. So, you know, a mechanical device in those situations allows you to get free, to move on to the advanced airway, blah, 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 all those other things that you need to do without having to delay all that until more people show up on the scene so I can continue doing CPR so that now I can move toward taking care of the advanced stuff I need to be taken care of. So I think it's a great example for, yeah, we can do it. It's not helping any. Ultimately, all we're doing is 6 minutes of CPR and we're still totally consumed in doing CPR and we haven't got anything else done.
Yeah.
So
and that's exactly what happens.
Right.
That's exactly
we didn't help
happens.
The patient any ultimately, that's my point.
So. How long have you guys been using the Lucas now?
We're on our third year of the Lucas.
Okay.
Yeah, 3 years with the Lucas.
Are you looking at data? I mean, have you started looking at data yet? I mean, in that 3 year time frame, you guys have probably seen some changes or improvement, or are you not ready to publish that yet?
So the data is being crunched. As a matter of fact, I'm hoping later this month to have some really detailed information back about individual patients. I don't have a lot of outcome data ultimately. I have great ROSC data, but not so much outcome data. I'm working on that. But we had a really interesting and I guess sort of unique outlay of getting the device in place, and that is that we had budgetary constraints, so we were able to only purchase about half the number that we needed. So we chose to go ahead and do that, and then sort of randomly place those in units around the city. And it took us about a year to come up with an outside funding agency that was willing to buy the rest of them for us. So we had a year where we had half our trucks using them, half our trucks not using them, and we're able to compare our ROSC rates during that time,
yeah,
knowing that it was the same medics. The medics were rotating around from one truck to another, so we had a pretty good mix of keeping everything else kind of the same. We almost immediately saw about a 10% improvement in our ROSC rates that first 6 months, first year while we were had half of them out there, and then subsequently since that time, the gap has widened even further. Now that we have full implementation, we have ROSC rates over 40% currently.
Wow.
So it's been really amazing to see those changes occur, and I think it's part of the reason that the guys say, don't take my Lucas device away, because they're seeing that as well. It's so frequent. I mean, we do over 300 cardiac arrests a month. So
wow.
We got a lot of cardiac arrests, and so it's... We got a lot of data.
A
lot of guys that see it. We got a lot of guys that have a lot of experience doing cardiac arrest. They get one every rotation.
And this has been something, until these devices came along and the advances from pit crew CPR and all of that came along to say we need to do high performance, high quality resuscitation. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, as a CPR instructor, I was having a hard time getting people, in the fire service where I was, to be at all enthusiastic about their recertification. It was kind of a joke, Oh, well, this guy's going to stay dead. I don't know why I'm literally here. I am practicing on a mannequin. Mm-hmm. And based upon their experience, I couldn't say they were wrong.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you.
I couldn't turn to them and say, yeah, but you could save this person's life.
No.
Come on, Jamie. When's the last time we had a patient alive when we got to the hospital?
Well, if you look at,
it's not
resuscitation rates of less than 5%, you're talking 1 out of 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
Geez, it might take you, in my system, it would probably take you 2 years to get 20 cardiac arrests for one medic, mm-hmm. even at the high rate that we have. So you're saving one patient every 2 years.
Yeah.
The time frame is so long, you never see a patient survive this. If they do, it's like, well, we got lucky on that one.
Well,
right?
It's not just survival.
And that's just it. They just think it's luck, rather than something they did.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
But and now it's not just do they survive, but do they walk out of the hospital neurologically intact?
Exactly
that's the real goal.
And that's the data you're waiting for.
Yes,
to
it is.
Out.
And that's what we hope to get. I can certainly tell you that, just anecdotal, unfortunately, but we do. Do a recognition dinner every year where we invite
Excellent.
Some of our survivors to come back and reunite them with the crews and all that
too.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Really fun. And this past year we had 13 patients come back.
Wow.
11 of those people were resuscitated with the Lucas device.
Wow.
Where in the past, most of the folks that came back were not cardiac arrest patients. They were something else. They were bad burns or injuries or whatever. Almost every patient in our dinner was a cardiac arrest patient. And again, 11 of the 13 were back there because of what many thought was because of the Lucas device. As a matter of fact, we have one lady who has had two cardiac arrests 3 months apart. Both times was resuscitated with the Lucas device.
Wow.
And I think is the only patient in the country that's had the Lucas twice now.
Oh, my God.
By the same bypass
crew,
not take, or what
enough.
Was the...
She literally got stented the first time and had a reocclusion and a rearrest about 4 months later and another cardiac arrest and was resuscitated by the same crew.
What are the odds?
I mean,
like you said, it's probably the only person you can think of.
So neurologically intact through two cardiac arrests now.
Wow.
Excellent. Let me ask you this, Joe, being the QI person that I am. I think it's really critical. important. And as it relates to what Jamie was saying, these guys get, yeah, we're never going to save anybody. Well, we need to let them know when they do. Mm-hmm. How are you getting feedback to your people? Because we give them feedback down to the, you know, everything that happened in that code. We have a database that said, okay, this is your compression rate. Of course, with Lucas, that's not an issue. But, you know, your breathing, your timing, your the whole nine. How long did you stop for one thing or another? Mm-hmm. And did the patient survive? And like you were saying, that outcome data is critical. It's not always that easy to get, unfortunately, but it is critical. Did this person walk out of the hospital intact?
Exactly.
And that is what's going to help your situation, saying, yes, you did save this life.
Yeah, and we've
and
seen the same results
change their whole mindset.
With our STEMI program, where we have a very robust STEMI program. And so, you know, a couple of days later, the crew gets a sheet of paper that's got, you know, the times on it. And this patient had a 99% LAD lesion. Here's a picture of his calf. You know, before, here's a picture after the stent was put in, guy went home in 2 days, et cetera. So that kind of
that
feedback is incredibly
valuable.
You're right. You got to know that what you're doing is actually making a difference, and not just right there, but down the road for those patients.
And the next time they recert, maybe they'll come in with a little different attitude. It's like, yeah, I actually
Well, we see what
people.
We're doing now actually does make a difference.
It does
and
work.
So it is important to do
Well,
it,
just
do it
getting
well.
The improved ROSC rates, and we're seeing that too, now that we're using the Lucas consistently. We are seeing the change in the attitude of the responders, that now cardiac arrests are real emergencies again.
Right.
Whereas
exactly
before
right.
it was like, cardiac arrest.
It's like how we used to treat stroke,
right?
Yeah, I'm going to be doing CPR.
Yeah.
You're having a stroke, have a seat over there, and we'll see how you do in a few weeks.
Yeah.
We hope you recover. I mean, you know, we sort of used to do nothing. Cardiac arrest is the same way. So I think it is making a big difference in people now appreciating the fact that the stuff that we are doing really does make a difference, and they see that much more frequently now, enough to encourage them to continue to do things as best they
can. And it's great when those survivors can meet the people that saved them. And same thing with the providers.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a crew at our award ceremony where the patient wanted to know how their arrest went and what things happened. At the same time, he's holding his chest when he's hearing about compressions and the Lucas device. And, yeah, but it's intriguing. And just to listen to that conversation of these people talking to this man, that the last time they saw him, he wasn't alive.
Yeah.
Right.
It's fascinating.
We've had several interesting discussions with our cardiology and emergency medicine colleagues about, you know, transporting these patients into the ED with the Lucas device going and the patient beginning to mentate some, trying to actually, you know, open eyes and look around and make some movements, et cetera. And in a couple of instances have actually been able to take the patients to the cath lab on the Lucas device, generating enough of a blood pressure to perfuse the patient and allow the cardiologist to be able to move forward with the cardiac catheterization while the Lucas device is
going. Are your hospitals investing in Lucas? Because we found, since we're bringing them in, there's patients
the same thing's happening in our region.
Generally can't be saved because, like you say, they have to get them right to the cath lab, so the hospitals are really looking more at that option.
We're seeing the same thing. We stay around with the device until the hospital sort of says we're done with it, but we are also seeing hospitals now purchasing their own for their in-house cardiac arrest.
No, they don't want to give it back.
Yeah, and they don't want to give it back. You're right. So now we have a way to just either swap out or whatever to allow us to get back in service.
So that's going to keep getting better, and the hospital level of care is going to change because of the Lucas.
Yeah.
Now they have a tool they didn't have before.
I think it's another example of now EMS driving hospital changes
in
care.
Good point.
Which is good to see. I mean, because I think it helps them recognize EMS as a part of that healthcare system.
Absolutely.
And the care we're providing is influencing the way that they do business or operate on patient care and are able to get out there and influence that. It makes me feel good.
Absolutely.
As a provider.
It's a
Absolutely.
Team. We're a team.
Exactly right.
A healthcare team, and all components of it are critically important.
Joe, as we wrap up here, tell folks where we can find more about what you're doing. I know with Paragon Medical Education Group, you do a lot of great training and on specific disaster-related topics and things like that. But tell folks a little bit about that.
Well, so you can certainly find me on social media. I'm on Facebook, and Paragon Medical Group is also on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com and on Facebook, same moniker. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Excellent. And Sam, how about you?
Sam Bradley pretty much anywhere. Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and on disasterpodcast.com. Please go there. You can get any of us on that site.
Yeah, we're actually the regular crew for the Disaster Podcast team, and we really, you know, check out that show. It's another one of the shows that I do, and
we're
and
proud
real proud of
it.
And making some interesting changes in way people think about disaster medicine. Just talking to a few people here at the show that are audience members, people I've talked to. I think we've all kind of encountered a few of them over recent weeks.
And that's fun.
It's been fun.
I really enjoy
that.
It really is. Great. Well, I want to thank all of you. Of course, you can find me at podmedic@mac.com to email me, podmedic on your most social media sites, and of course here at the MedicCast at mediccast.com/blog. Check out the show. Check out the show notes for links to these two folks. And also, thank Physio-Control for coming
in
and sponsoring this episode. Check out the Lucas device for yourself. Have them come in and bring in a unit for you to trial in your service. See if it's the right device for you. It is something you're going to have to put in procedures in place to do, and just like any other new tool, but I think you might be interested in seeing how it affects the way you manage and handle those cardiac arrest patients.
And your providers,
I'm Jim Davis, the PodMedic. We're here at EMS World Expo. I want to thank all the team from EMS World for having us back and covering the show here. We'll be back with more segments here in the podcast studio. In the meantime, remember, Scene Safety, BSI.
Yep.